People busied themselves making things when they were sitting around talking or listening to stories out of materials that were collected whenever they were found. So there was always some cordage around for anyone to use. Ayla got some strips of leather thong and a long piece of thin flexible rope that were hanging on pegs pounded into posts near the entrance. After she had cut off the belly part into a circular shape, she folded the rest of the hide, then coiled up the rope and put it on top. She measured out a length of the leather thong around her neck, added additional length, then threaded it through the holes she cut around the edge of the leather circle. She seldom wore her amulet anymore, not even her more modern one. Most Zelandanyi wore necklaces, and it was hard to wear a lumpy leather pouch and a necklace at the same time. Instead, she usually kept her amulet in her medicine bag, which she customarily wore attached to a belt or waist thong. It wasn't a clan medicine bag. She had thought about making another one several times, but never seemed to find the time. Releasing the drawstring that held her medicine bag closed, she searched inside and pulled out the small decorated pouch, her amulet, that was full of odd-shaped objects. She undid the knots and poured the strange collection of objects into her hand. They were the signs from her totem that signified important moments in her life. Most of them were given to her by the spirit of the great cave lion after she had made a critical decision as a sign that she had made the right choice, but not all. The piece of red ochre that was the first object to go into the bag was worn smooth. It was given to her by Issa when she was accepted into the clan. Ayla put it into the new amulet. The piece of black manganese dioxide that was given to her when she became a medicine woman was also worn down just from being inside the small pouch with the other objects for so long. The red and black material that was often used for coloration had left their residue on the other objects in the pouch. The mineral objects could be brushed off, such as the fossil cast of a seashell, the sign from her totem that her decision to hunt was proper for her, even though she was female. "He must have known even then that I would need to hunt if I was going to survive," she thought. "My cave lion even told Brunn to let me hunt, although then only with the sling." The disc of mammoth ivory, her hunting talisman that had been given to her when she was declared the woman who hunts, had absorbed color that couldn't be brushed off, mostly red from the ochre. She picked up the piece of iron pyrite and rubbed it against her tunic. It was her favorite sign. It was the one that told her she had been right to run away with Dirk. If she hadn't, he would have been exposed without anyone thinking any more about it, since he had been judged deformed. When she took him and hid, knowing she could die as well, it made Brunn and Kreb stop and think. The colored dust clung to the clear quartz crystal, but didn't discolor it. That was the sign she found that told her she had made the right decision to stop looking for her people and stay in the Valley of Horses for a while. It always bothered her when she saw the black manganese stone. She picked it up again and held it in her closed fist. It held the spirits of all the people of the clan. She had exchanged a piece of her spirit for it, so that when she saved someone's life, they incurred no obligation to her, since she already had a piece of everyone's spirit. When Issa died, Kreb, the Mogur, had taken her medicine woman stone from her before she was buried, so she would not take the entire clan to the spirit world with her. But no one took her stone when Braud cursed her with death. Guv had not been Mogur for very long, and it came as such a shock to everyone when Braud did it. No one remembered to get the stone from her, and she forgot to return it. What would happen to the clan if she still had the stone when she passed to the next world? She put all of her totem signs into the new pouch, and knew she would keep them there from then on. It felt right for her clan totem signs to be in a clan amulet pouch. As she pulled the drawstring tight, she wondered, as she often had, why she had never been given a sign from her totem when she decided to leave the Mamutoi and go with Jandalar. Had she already become a child of the mother? Had the mother told her totem she didn't need a sign? Had she been given a more subtle sign that she didn't recognize? Or, a new and more frightening thought came to her, had she made the wrong decision? She felt a cold chill. For the first time in a long time, Ayla clutched her amulet and sent a silent thought asking for his protection to the spirit of the great cave lion. When she left the temporary dwelling, Ayla was carrying a folded-up buckskin hide, a leather rucksack lumpy with the objects it held, and her clan medicine bag. There were several more people around the campfire, and she waved to them as she left, but it wasn't the usual beckoning come-back motion with her palm facing inward toward herself, which commonly signified a temporary separation, acknowledging that she would see them soon. She had raised her hand, palm facing out, and moved it slightly from side to side. Marthona frowned at the signal. As she started walking upstream along the small river, a quicker way toward the cave she had found a few years before, Ayla was beginning to wonder whether she should go through with this ceremony. Yes, Zelandani would be disappointed, and so would the rest of the Zelandania who were preparing to assist, but it was more dangerous than they realized. When she agreed to the ceremony the day before, she had been so depressed she didn't care if she got lost in the black void. But she was feeling better this morning, especially after her bath in the river and seeing John Ayla and Wolf, not to mention Marthona and Proliva. She wasn't as ready to face that terrifying black void now. Maybe she should tell Zelandani that she had changed her mind. She hadn't thought about the danger she was facing while she was making her preliminary preparations, but she had felt uncomfortable about her inability to perform all of the rituals in the proper way. That was a very important aspect of clan ceremony, unlike the Zelandani, who were more tolerant of deviation. Even the words of the mother's song varied slightly from cave to cave, which was a favored topic of discussion among the Zelandania, and that was the most important elder legend of all. If such a legend had been a sacred part of clan ceremonies, it would have been memorized and recited in precisely the same way every time it was repeated, at least among the clans that had regular direct contact with each other. Even those clans from distant regions would have had a version that was very close. That was why she could communicate in the sacred sign language of the clan with the clans in this region, though it was a year's travel away from the clan she grew up with. There were minor differences, but it was amazingly similar. Since it was a clan ceremony she would be performing, using powerful roots prepared according to clan procedures, she felt everything should be done as close as possible according to clan tradition. She believed it was the only way she could hope to maintain any control, and she was beginning to have doubts if even that would help. She was walking past the wooded area with her mind deep in thought when she nearly bumped into someone coming out from behind a tree. She was startled to find herself practically in Jandalar's arms. He was even more surprised and at a complete loss about what to do. His first impulse was to finish what the accident had started and put his arms around her. He'd been longing to do it for so long, but catching a glimpse of her shocked expression, he jumped back, assuming somehow that her surprise meant revulsion, that she didn't want him to touch her. Her reaction to his instant avoidance was that he didn't want her, couldn't stand to be near her. They stared at each other for a long moment. It was the closest they had been since she found him with Marona, and in their hearts, each yearn to prolong that moment, to broach the emotional distance that seemed to separate them. But a child running down the path they were on distracted them. They looked away for a moment and then couldn't quite look back.
Sorry,
Jandalar said, aching to hold her, but afraid she would rebuff him. He was so completely at a loss. He was looking around wildly like an animal caught in a trap.
Doesn't matter,
Ayla said, looking down to hide the tears that were just too ready to flow these days. She didn't want him to see how terrible it made her feel to think that he couldn't stand to be close to her, that he couldn't wait to get away. Without looking up, she started walking again, hurrying before her overflowing eyes gave her away. Jandalar had to fight his own tears as he watched her almost running along the path in her hurry to get away from him. Ayla continued along what had become a faint path towards the new cave, although it was likely that every one of the entire family of Zelandanyi people had been inside the new cave at least once. It wasn't used often. Because it was so beautiful and so unusual, with its nearly white stone walls, it was considered a very spiritual, very sacred place, and still rather inviolable. The Zelandania and cave leaders were still working out the appropriate times and ways to use it. Traditions hadn't been developed yet. It was all too new. As she approached the base of the small hill that held the cave, she noticed that the obstructing brush and the fallen tree, whose uplifted roots had originally exposed the opening to the underground chambers, were cleared away. Dirt and stones around the opening had also been removed, which enlarged the entrance. Although she wasn't looking forward to the ceremony she had been preparing for, she had been excited about seeing the cave again, but the lighter mood that had almost made her decide to forego this dangerous ceremony was gone. Her unhappiness matched the black void she was facing. What did it matter if she lost herself there? It couldn't be any worse than the way she felt at that moment. She was struggling to regain the self-control that seemed so elusive today. It almost seemed she had been on the verge of tears since she woke up. She took a shallow stone bowl from her leather sack and a fur package. Inside was a small, nearly watertight bag of fat with a stoppered end, that was wrapped and tied in the piece of fur to keep any seeping grease from damaging anything nearby. She found her package of lichen wicks, poured a little oil in the bowl, soaked a wick in it for a few moments, then pulled it out, and leaned it against the edge of the bowl-shaped lamp. She was preparing to use her firestone to light when she saw two more Zelandania walking up the path. The sight of the Zelandania brought Ayla an added measure of composure. She was still new to their ranks and wanted to keep their respect. They greeted each other and spoke of inconsequential matters. Then one of them held the lamp while watching Ayla start a small fire on the ground with her firestone. Once the lamp was lit, she smothered the fire with dirt and all three entered the cave. Once they passed through the warmth of the entrance area and entered the total darkness of the inside, the temperature cooled to the ambient temperature of most caves, about 55 degrees. There was little conversation as they picked their way along exposed rocks and slippery clay, with only a single lamp to show the way. By the time they reached a larger chamber, their eyes were so accustomed to the dark that the lights from many stone lamps seemed almost bright. Most of the Zelandania had already arrived and were waiting for Ayla.
"There you are, Zelandani of the Ninth Cave," the first said. "Have you made all the preparations you think are necessary?"
"Not quite," Ayla said. "I still have to change. During the clan ceremony, I would be naked except for my amulet and the colors painted on my body by the Mogur when I make the drink. But it's too cold in the cave to be naked for very long, and besides, the Mogurs who drank the liquid wore clothes, so I will, too. I think it's important to stay as close to the clan ceremony as possible, so I've decided to wear a wrap in the style of a clan woman. I made a clan amulet for my totem symbols, and to show that I am a medicine woman, I will wear my clan medicine bag, although it is the objects in my amulet that are more important. It will enable the clan spirits to recognize me not only as a woman of the clan, but as a medicine woman. With all the Zelandania looking on with great curiosity, Ayla removed her clothing and began wrapping the soft, pliable deer hide around her, tying it on her with a long cord in such a way as to leave pouches and folds to hold things. She thought about all the things she was doing that were not clan, starting with her preparing the drink for herself instead of for the Mogurs. She was not a Mogur. No woman of the clan could be one, and she didn't know the rituals they performed to ready themselves for this ceremony. But she was a Zelandani, and she hoped that would make a difference once she reached the spirit world. She took a small pouch out of her medicine bag. There was enough light from the many lamps to show its deep red ochre color, the color most sacred to the clan. And then she took a wooden bowl out of the leather pack frame. She had made the bowl some time ago in the style of the clan to show Marthona, who, with her aesthetic sense, appreciated the simplicity and craftsmanship. Ayla had planned to give it to the woman, and now she was glad she still had it. If it wasn't the special bowl that had been used only for this route for the many generations of Issa's ancestors, it was at least a wooden bowl made in the painstaking way the clan made them. "I will need some water," Ayla said, as she undid the knots of the red pouch. She emptied the bag of roots into her hand. "May I see them?" Zelandani asked. Ayla held them out to her, but there was nothing distinctive about them. They were just dried roots. "I'm not sure how much to use," she said, picking out two small pieces, hoping it would be correct. "I've only done this twice before, and I don't have Issa's memories." A few of the Zelandania there had heard her speak about clan memories, but most had no idea what she meant. She had tried to explain them to Zelandani who was first, but since she didn't know exactly what they were herself, it was hard to explain to someone else. Someone poured water into her wooden bowl, and Ayla drank a little to wet her mouth. She remembered how dry the roots were and how hard they were to chew. "I am ready," she said, and before she could change her mind, she put the roots in her mouth and began to chew. It took a long time to soften them up enough to bite through, and though she did try to avoid swallowing her own saliva, it was difficult, and she thought to herself, "Since I'm the one who's going to drink it, maybe it doesn't matter too much." She chewed and chewed and chewed and chewed. It seemed to take forever. But finally her mouth held a soggy pulp, which she spit into the bowl. She stirred it with her finger and watched the liquid turn a milky white. Zelandani was looking over her shoulder. "Is that what it's supposed to do?" She seemed to be trying to detect its odor. "Yes," Ayla said. She could feel its primeval taste in her mouth. "Would you like to smell it?"
"It smells ancient," the woman said, "like a deep, cool, wet forest full of moss and mushrooms. May I taste it?" She was going to refuse. It was so sacred to the clan, Issa couldn't even make some just to show her how, and for a moment Ayla was appalled that Zelandani would ask. But then she realized this whole experiment was so far from anything the clan would do that it could hardly matter if Zelandani took a drink. Ayla held the bowl to the woman's lips and watched her take much more than a sip and pulled it back before she took too much. Then she held it to her own mouth and drank it down quickly, making sure there was none left for anyone else to sample. That was how she got in trouble the first time. Isa had told her there was not supposed to be any left, but she had made too much, and after his first taste, the Mogur knew it was too strong. He controlled how much each man drank, and left some in the bottom of the bowl. Ayla had found it later, after she had ingested too much from chewing the root and had too much of the women's drink besides. She was in such a confused state, she drank the rest down so none would be left. This time she would make sure no one else would inadvertently be tempted to try it.
"When should we start to chant for you?"
the first asked. Ayla almost forgot about the chanting.
"Probably should have started already," she said,
a slight slur in her voice already. The first was feeling the effects of her rather large taste as well, and struggled to keep her control as she signaled the Zelandania to begin chanting. "That is a powerful root," she thought, "and I only had one drink. What must Ayla be feeling now after all she drank?" Zelandani thought. The ancient taste was familiar, and it brought on feelings Ayla would never forget, memories and associations of the other times she had tasted the drink, and of times long past. She felt the cool and damp of a deep forest, as though she was enveloped within it, with trees so huge it was difficult to find a way around and between them as she climbed up the steep side of a mountain, followed by the horse. Lichen, damply soft and silvery grayish-green, draped the trees, and moss covered the ground and rocks and logs of dead trees in a continuous carpet that ranged in shades from bright true green to deep pine green to rich, earthy, brownish-green, and all shades in between. Ayla could smell fungus, mushrooms of every size and shape, fragile white wings sprouting from fallen trees, thick woody shelves attached to old stumps, large, dense, sponge-like, brown-capped, tiny, delicate, thin-stemmed. There were honey-colored tight clusters, compact round spheres, shiny red tops with white spots, tall, smooth caps that melted to black ooze, ghostly white, perfect caps of death, and many more. She knew them all, tasted them all, felt them all. She was in a great delta of a huge river, carried by a stream of muddy brown water, breaking through thick stands of tall phragmite reeds and cattails, and floating islands with trees and wolves that climbed them, spinning round and round in a small leather-covered bowl boat, rising up and floating on a cushion of air. Ayla didn't know her knees had buckled as she went limp and dropped to the ground. She was picked up by several Zelandania and carried to a resting place that Zelandani had thought to have brought into the cave for her. The first almost wished she had one as well as she reached for her strong, padded wicker stool. She struggled to stay aware, to watch Ayla, and felt a dark tinge of worry start to develop in the back of her mind. Ayla was feeling peaceful, quiet, sinking into a soft mist that was drawing her deeper in until she was surrounded. It thickened around her into a fog that obscured all vision, then became a heavy, damp cloud. She felt swallowed by it. She was suffocating, struggled to breathe, gasped for air, then felt herself begin to move. She was moving faster and faster, caught in the middle of the suffocating cloud, rushing so fast it took her breath away, left her with no air. The cloud wrapped itself around her, squeezed her, pushing in from all sides, contracting, expanding, contracting, like something alive. It forced her to move with accelerating velocity until she fell into a deep, black, empty space. A place as black as the inside of a cave, mindless, terrifying. It would have been less terrifying if she had simply dropped into sleep, become unconscious, as it appeared she had to those watching. But she was not. She couldn't move, didn't really have a desire to move, but when she tried to focus her will to move something, even just a finger, she could not. She couldn't even feel her finger or any other part of herself. She couldn't open her eyes or turn her head. She had no volition, no will, but she could hear. At some level, she was aware. As though from a distance and yet with great clarity, she could hear the chant of the Zelandania. She could hear the faint murmur of voices from one corner. Though she couldn't make out what they were saying, she could even hear her own heart beating. Each Danyer chose a sound, a tone with a pitch and timbre each one was comfortable with on a sustained level. When they wanted to maintain a continuous chant, several of the Danyers would begin to make their tone. The combination might or might not be harmonic. It didn't matter. Before the first one got out of breath, another voice would join in, and then another, and another at random intervals. The result was a droning, interweaving fugue of tones that could go on indefinitely. If there were enough people to provide sufficient rest for those people who had to stop for a while. For Ayla, it was a comforting sound that was there, but that tended to fade into the background as her mind observed scenes only she could see behind her closed eyelids, visions with the lucid incoherence of vivid dreams. It felt as though she were wide awake, dreaming. At first, she kept gaining speed in the black space. She knew it, though the void remained unchanged. She was terrified and alone, achingly alone. There were no sensations, no taste, no smell, no sound, no sight, no touch, as though none ever existed or ever would, just her conscious, screaming mind. An eternity passed. Then, at a great distance, barely discernible, a faint glimmer of light. She reached for it, strove for it. Anything, anything at all was better than nothing. Her striving pulled her faster. The light expanded into an amorphous, barely perceptible blur, and for a moment she wondered if her mind might have any other effects on the state she was in. The indistinct light thickened to a cloudiness and darkened with colors, alien colors with unknown names. She was sinking into the cloud, falling through it faster and faster, and then she fell out the bottom. A strangely familiar landscape opened up below her, full of repetitive geometric shapes, squares and sharp angles, bright, shining, filled with light, repeating, climbing up. Nothing with such straight, sharp shapes existed in her familiar natural world. White ribbons seemed to flow along the ground in this strange place, reaching straight into the distance, with strange animals racing along it. As she drew closer, she saw people, masses of squirming, wriggling people, all pointing their fingers at her. "You! You! You!" they were saying. It was almost a chant. She saw a figure standing alone. It was a man of mixed spirits. As she got closer, she thought he looked familiar, but not quite. At first, she thought it was Echazar, but then it seemed to be Brukhaval, and the people were saying, "You, you did it. You brought the knowledge. You did it." "No," her mind screamed. "It was the mother. She gave me the knowledge. Where's the mother?" "The mother is gone. Only the son remains," the people said. "You did it." She looked at the man and suddenly knew who he was, though his face was in shadow and she couldn't see him clearly.
"I couldn't help it. I was cursed. I had to leave my son. Braut made me go," her soundless voice cried out.
"The mother is gone. Only the son remains." In her thoughts, Ayla frowned. What did it mean? Suddenly the world below took on different dimension, but still ominous and otherworldly. The people were gone, and the strange geometric shapes. It was an empty, desolate, wind-blown prairie. Two men appeared, brothers, whom no one would guess were brothers. One was tall and blonde, like Jandalar. The other, older one, she knew was Dirk, though his face was still shadowed. The two brothers approached each other from opposite directions, and she felt great anxiety, as though something terrible was about to happen, something she had to prevent. With a shock of terror, she was sure one of her sons would kill the other. With arms raised as though to strike, they drew closer. She strained to reach them. Suddenly, Mammut was there, holding her back.
"It is not what you think. It is a symbol, a message," he said. "Watch and wait."
A third man appeared on the wind-blown steps. It was Braud, looking at her with a glare of pure hatred. The first two men reached each other, then both turned to face Braud.
"Curse him! Curse him! Curse him with death!"
Dirk motioned.
"But he is your father, Dirk,"
Aayla thought with silent apprehension.
"You should not be the one to curse him."
"He is cursed already," her other son said. "You did it. You kept the black stone. They are all cursed."
"No, no,"
Aayla screamed.
"I'll give it back. I can still give it back."
"There is nothing you can do, Aayla. It is your destiny,"
Mammut said. When she turned to face him, Kreb was standing beside him.
"You gave us Dirk," the old Mogur signed. "That was also your destiny. Dirk is part of the others, but his clan too. The clan is doomed. It will be no more. Only your kind will go on, and the ones like Dirk, the children of mixed spirits. Not many, perhaps, but enough. It won't be the same. He will become like the others, but it is something. Dirk is the son of the clan, Aayla. He's the only son of the clan."
Aayla heard a woman weeping, and when she looked, the scene had changed again. It was dark. They were deep in a cave. Then lamps were lit, and she saw a woman holding a man in her arms. The man was her tall, blonde son, and when the woman looked up, to her surprise, Aayla saw herself, but she was not clear. It was as though she was seeing herself in a reflector. A man came and looked down at them. She looked up and saw Jandalar.
"Where is my son?" he asked her. "Where is my son?"
"I gave him to the mother," the reflected Aayla cried. "The great Earth Mother wanted him. She is powerful. She took him from me."
Suddenly, Aayla heard the crowd and saw the strange geometric shapes.
"The Earth Mother grows weak," the voices chanted. "Her children ignore her. When they no longer honor her, she will be ravished."
"No,"
the reflected Aayla wailed.
"Who will feed us? Who will care for us? Who will provide for us if we don't honor her?"
"The mother is gone. Only the son remains. The mother's children are no longer children. They have left the mother behind. They have the knowledge. They have come of age, as she knew someday they would."
The woman still wept, but she wasn't Aayla anymore. She was the mother, weeping because her children were gone. Aayla felt herself being pulled out of the cave. She was weeping, too. The voices became faint, as though they were chanting from a great distance away. She was moving again, high above a vast grassy plain full of great herds. Aurochs were stampeding, and horses were racing to keep up with them. Bison and deer were running, and ibex. She drew closer, began to see individual animals, the ones she had seen when she was called to the Zelandania, and the disguises that they had worn during the ceremony when they had given the mother's new gift to her children, when she recited the last verse of the mother's song. Two bison bulls running past each other, great aurochs bulls marching towards each other, a huge cow almost flying in the air, and another one giving birth, a horse at the end of a passage falling down a cliff many horses, most in colors, browns and reds and blacks, and Winnie with the spotted hide over her back and across her face, and the two stick-like antlers. Chapter 40 Zelandani was not with Ayla on her arcane inward journey, but she sensed it and felt herself pulled toward it. Perhaps if she had consumed more of the drink, she might have been drawn in with Ayla and become lost in the enigmatic landscape induced by the root. As it was, she did lose control of her faculties for a period of time and had her own difficulties. The Zelandania weren't quite sure what was going on. Ayla appeared to be unconscious, and the first seemed close to it. She wasn't exactly dozing off, but she would slump down, and her eyes would glaze over as if she was gazing into some unseen distance. Then she would rouse herself and say things that didn't always make sense. She did not appear to be in control of the experiment, which was unusual in itself, and she definitely was not in control of herself, which made them all nervous. Those who knew her best were most alarmed, but they did not want to spread their concern among the rest. The first shook herself awake, as if by an act of will.
"Gold, gold,"
she said, then slumped over again, and her eyes glazed. The next time she jerked herself awake, she shouted,
"Cover, fur, cover, Ayla! Cold, so cold, get hot!"
Then she was gone again. They had brought a few warm coverings with them just because it was always cool in a cave. They had already put one on Ayla, but the 11th decided to add another one. When she happened to touch the young woman, she was surprised.
"She is cold, almost as cold as death," she said.
"Is she breathing?" the third asked.
The 11th bent over and looked closely, noticed a slight movement of her chest, and felt a faint sigh of air from her barely open mouth.
"Yes, she's breathing, but it's shallow."
"Do you think we should make some hot tea?"
the fifth asked.
"Yes, I think so, for both of them," the third said.
"A stimulating tea or a soothing one?" said the fifth.
"I don't know. Either one could react with that root in an unexpected way," the third said.
"Let's try to ask the first. She's the one who should decide," the 11th said. Her companions nodded. The three of them surrounded the large woman who was sitting on her stool, slumped over. The third put her hand on the first's shoulder and gently nudged her, and then a little harder. Zelandani jerked awake.
"Do you want hot tea?" the third asked.
"Yes, yes,"
the first said, loudly again, as though shouting helped her stay awake.
"Ayla, too?"
"Yes, hot."
"Tea to stimulate or soothe?" the 11th asked, also speaking loudly. The Zelandani of the 14th cave walked over, frowning with concern.
No.
The first stopped, straining to concentrate.
"Water! Just hot water,"
she said. She shook herself again, trying to stay awake.
"Help me up."
"Are you sure you can stand?" the third asked. "You don't want to fall."
"Help me up. Need to stay awake. Ayla needs help."
She started to fall off again and shook herself violently.
"Help me stand. Get hot. Water, not tea."
The third, 11th, and 14th all crowded around the hugely corpulent woman who was the first among those to serve the mother, and with some effort got her up on her feet. She wavered drunkenly, leaned heavily on two of the Zelandani, and shook her head again. She closed her eyes, and her expression took on a look of intense concentration. When she opened them, she was gritting her teeth with determination, but had stopped swaying.
"Ayla's in trouble," she said. "My fault. Should have known."
She was still having difficulty concentrating, thinking straight, but being up and moving around did help. The hot water did, too, if only to warm her. She felt cold, a deep, bone-chilling cold, and she knew it wasn't just being in the cave.
Too cold. Move her. Need fire. Warmth.
You want us to move Ayla out of the cave? The 14th said.
Yes. Too cold.
Should we wake her? The 11th asked.
I don't think you can, the 1st said. But try.
First, they tried gently shaking her. Then not so gently. Ayla didn't stir. They tried talking to her, then shouting, but they couldn't rouse her. Zelandani of the 3rd asked the 1st,
Should we continue chanting?
Yes, chant. Don't stop. It's all she's got,
the Zelandani who was 1st shouted. The higher-ranked Zelandania gave a few instructions. Suddenly there was a flurry of activity as several people rushed outside and hurried to the Zelandania lodge, some to stir up a fire for hot water, others to get a litter to carry the young woman out of the cave. The rest renewed the chanting with fervor. Several people were near the Zelandania lodge. A meeting of the couples planning to tie the knot at the late matrimonial had been planned later in the day, and a few of them had started to gather. Falara and Aldenor were among them. When several Zelandania came rushing toward the lodge, Falara and Aldenor looked at each other with concern.
"What's wrong? Why is everyone in such a hurry?"
Falara asked.
"It's the new Zelandani," a young man answered, one of the newer acolytes.
"You mean Ayla? Zelandani of the 9th?"
"Yes. She made a special drink using some kind of root, and the 1st said we have to get her out of the cave because it's too cold. She's not waking up," the acolyte answered.
They heard a commotion and turned to look. A couple of strong young Danyers were helping the 1st back from the cave. She was having difficulty keeping her balance and finding her footing without stumbling. Falara had never seen Zelandani so unstable. A wave of apprehension washed over her. The one who was 1st was always so completely self-assured, so positive. Even with her great size, she always moved with confidence and ease. It had been bad enough for the young woman to watch her mother weakening. It was utterly frightening to see someone she had always thought of as an unshakable force, a bulwark of security and strength, suddenly show such debility. About the time that the 1st reached the lodge, another group of Zelandania appeared on the path leading down from the new cave, carrying a litter, piled high with furs. As the procession approached, Falara and Aldenor could hear the distinctive interwoven sounds of Zelandania chanting. When the litter passed by, Falara looked at the young woman she had come to know and love, her brother's mate. Ayla's face was pasty white, and her breathing so shallow she didn't seem to be moving at all. Falara was horrified, and Aldenor could see her alarm.
"We have to get Mother and Proliva and Joharan," she said, "and Jondalar."
Although it was difficult and even a little embarrassing, the walk down to the lodge from the cave had helped to clear Zelandani's head. She dropped down on her large, comfortable stool gratefully and was glad for the cup of hot water. She hadn't dared to suggest an herb or medicinal to counteract the effects of the root, not when she wasn't thinking clearly, for fear its reaction in combination with the root might make the effects worse. Now that her head was more clear, though her body was still feeling the effects of the powerful root, she decided to experiment on herself. She added some stimulating herbs to a second cup of hot water and sipped it slowly, trying to judge if she could feel anything. She wasn't sure if they helped, but at least they didn't seem to make things worse. She stood up and, with a little assistance, went back to the bed recently vacated by Larimar, where they had put Ayla.
"Have you tried to give her hot water?" she asked.
"We haven't been able to get her mouth open," said a young acolyte who was standing nearby.
The 1st tried to pry Ayla's mouth open, but her jaws were clamped shut,
as though she was straining against something with all her might. The Danyer pulled back the covers and noticed her whole body was rigid. She was icy cold and clammy to the touch, in spite of all the furs on her. "Pour some hot water in that large bowl," she said to the young man. Several others who were standing around hurried to help him. She hadn't been able to open the young woman's mouth. If she couldn't get any heat inside her, she would have to try to apply more heat from the outside. The first took several of the pieces of bandage material, both soft skins and fabric, that were still nearby, and dumped them into the bowl of steaming water. Carefully, she squeezed the hot liquid out and applied a hot dressing to Ayla's arm. By the time she put another one on the other arm, the first one was cold. "Keep more hot water coming," she said. She untied the rope that was wrapped around Ayla's garment, and with the help of several Zelandania to lift her, unwound it from around her, noting the ingenious way it had secured the buckskin on her. Ayla was not quite naked, the first noted. She was wearing an arrangement of straps that held on the absorbent leather pad stuffed with cattail fuzz between her legs. "It is either her moon time, or she is still bleeding from the miscarriage," Zelandani thought. "If nothing else, it means Larimar did not start new life in her." Matter-of-factly, the Danyer checked to see if she needed to be changed, but it appeared she was at the end of her flow. It was barely soiled, and she left the pad intact. Then, with the help of several other Danyers, she began placing hot, damp, absorbent skins and cloths on Ayla in an attempt to drive away the deep cold that held the young woman. She herself had had only a taste of the internal chill, but it was enough to make her appreciate just how cold it felt. Finally, after many applications of heat, Ayla's rigid body seemed to relax, at least her jaw unclamped. Zelandani hoped it was a good sign, but she had no way of knowing for sure. She personally covered Ayla with warm furs. It was all she could do for now. Her large, sturdy stool was brought, and the one who was first sat beside the newest Zelandani and began her anxious vigil. For the first time she became conscious of the chanting that had been continuous from the beginning, with some joining in and others dropping out as they grew tired. "We may have to bring in more people to maintain it if this wait goes on too long." Zelandani didn't even want to think beyond the wait. When she did, she kept in her mind the thought that Ayla would eventually wake up and she would be fine. Any other outcome was too painful to contemplate. "If I hadn't been so curious about those intriguing new roots, would I have been more perceptive?" the first wondered. Ayla did seem rather upset and nervous when she arrived, but all the Zelandania were there and looking forward to this unique ceremony in the new cave. She had watched Ayla chewing the roots for a long time and finally spitting them into the bowl of water, and then she decided to try some herself. That was her first warning. The effects that she felt from that single drink were so much greater than she had anticipated. Though she'd had some bad moments, she was glad now that she did. It gave her a sense of what Ayla was going through. Who would have thought that such innocuous-looking dried roots could be so powerful? What were they? Did the plant grow anywhere nearby? It obviously had some unique properties, some of which might be beneficial for specific uses, but if there was to be any further experimentation, it would have to be under much more careful and controlled circumstances. It was a very dangerous route. She had barely settled into the meditative state she usually assumed for long vigils when one of the Zelandania approached the first. Marthona and Proliva, along with Folara, had arrived and were asking to come in.
"Of course they can come in," she said. "They may be of help, and we may need it before this is over."
When the three women were ushered in, they noticed several Zelandania were chanting over a bed near the back. Zelandani was sitting beside it.
"What happened to Ayla?"
Marthona asked when she saw her lying pallid and unmoving on the bed.
"I wish I knew for sure," Zelandani said, "and I'm afraid I may be largely to blame. Over the past few years, Ayla spoke occasionally about a root that was used by the Mogurs, I think she calls them, the ones of her clan who know of the spirits. They used it to help them enter the spirit world, though only as part of special ceremonies, or so I understood. The way she talked about the root, I was sure she had used it, but she was always very cryptic about it. She did say that the effects were very powerful. I was intrigued, of course. Anything that can assist the Zelandania to communicate with the next world is always of interest." Stools were brought for the three, and cups of chamomile tea. When they were settled, the first continued.
"I didn't know until recently that Ayla still had some of those roots, and that she believed they would still be effective. Frankly, I doubted it. Most herbs and medicinals lose strength over time. She claimed that if they were properly stored, they became concentrated, gained in strength over time. I thought perhaps a small experiment might get her to think about something besides her worries. I knew she was troubled over Jandalar and that whole sad incident the night of the festival, especially after miscarrying when she was called."
"You can't believe how difficult that was for her, Zelandani," Marthona said. "I know it is never easy to be called. That's part of it, I suppose. But with the miscarriage and all, I will tell you, there were moments when I thought we'd lose her. She bled so heavily. I was afraid she was bleeding her life away. I was almost ready to send for you. If it had continued like that much longer, I would have, though I'm not sure you would have arrived in time."
Zelandani nodded. "Perhaps you shouldn't have let her come so soon," she said.
"There was no way I could stop her. You know how she is when she decides she wants to do something," Marthona said. Zelandani nodded in acknowledgement. "She couldn't wait to see Jandalar and John Ayla, especially after losing one. She wanted to see her child, and I think she wanted to start another one. And she was sure she knew how. I think that's partly why she wanted to see Jandalar so bad."
"She saw him all right," Proliva said, "with Morona."
"I don't understand Jandi sometimes," Falara said. "Of all people, why couldn't he leave her alone?"
"Probably because she wouldn't leave him alone," Proliva said. "His needs have always been strong. She made it too easy."
"And then what does he do when she decides to take her turn at the festival?" Falara said. "It's not like she didn't have the right."
"Right or not, she didn't do it because she wanted to celebrate the mother at the festival," Zelandani said. "She did it out of hurt and anger. That's why she chose the man she did. She didn't want Larimar. She wanted to get back at Jandalar. That doesn't honor the mother, and she knows it. Neither of them are without fault, but I think both of them are trying to take all the blame on themselves, and that doesn't help."
"No matter who takes the blame, Jandalar will still have a harsh penalty to pay," Marthona said.
"I can't blame Larimar for not wanting to return to the Ninth Cave, and I'm glad the Fifth was willing to take him in, but his mate doesn't want to move," Proliva said. "She says the Ninth Cave is her home. She does have a good location. But if she stays without a mate, who's going to take care of that brood of hers?"
"Or supply the barma she drinks every day," Falara said.
"That may be what will encourage her to move to the Fifth," Zelandani said.
"Unless her eldest son takes over," Proliva said. "He's been learning to make that barma for several years,
Some say his is better than Larimar's, and there are enough people along our section of the river who would rather have a nearby source.
Well, don't suggest it to him, Marthona said.
It won't make any difference. If we can think of it, someone else is bound to as well, Proliva said.
Zelandani noticed two more people joining the ones who were chanting, and one leaving. She nodded her approval to them, then glanced at Ayla. Did her skin seem more gray? She hadn't moved, but somehow she seemed to have sunk deeper into the bed. The Danyer didn't like the way she looked. She went back to her explanation.
I was saying that I wanted to try to help Ayla get her mind off her problems, to get her to talk about other things which are usually of great interest to her. That's why I asked her about this clan root. But I'm not without fault either. I was too anxious to learn about it. I should have been paying closer attention to her. I should have seen how upset she really was, and I should have believed her about the potency of the clan root. I took only one drink and had to struggle to maintain control. It is far more powerful than I ever imagined, Zelandani said. I'm afraid Ayla is lost somewhere in the world of the spirits. The only thing I really remember her saying is that chanting was the tie that kept her bound to this world, and I could feel the pull of it when I was somewhat lost from just the one drink. I will be honest with you. I don't know what else to do for her, except to keep her warm and chant and hope it wears off soon.
The clan root. She told me about that, Marthona said. The one she calls Mammut said he would never try that route again, that he was afraid he would be lost forever. He told her it was too powerful, and he warned Ayla never to use it again. The first frowned.
Why didn't she tell me Mammut told her not to use that route? He was one who serves. He would know. Ayla was a little reluctant to try it at first, but she never told me why. And then she seemed perfectly willing, even performing clan rituals for it. She didn't tell me Mammut had warned her against it, Zelandani said, quite distraught.
The first got up and checked Ayla again. She was still cold and clammy, and her breath was hardly noticeable. If the Danyer had just seen her and touched her, she would have thought Ayla was dead. She lifted her eyelid. There was only a slight response. Zelandani had thought, hoped, that all Ayla needed was time for the effects to wear off. Now she was beginning to wonder if anything would bring her out of it. She looked around, beckoned to a particular acolyte.
Massage her gently. Try to bring some color to her skin, and let's try to get some warm tea into her, something stimulating.
And then louder, so everyone could hear.
Does anyone know where Jandalar is?
He's been taking long walks lately, usually by the river, Marthona said.
I saw him practically running in that direction earlier, an acolyte said.
Zelandani stood and clapped her hands for everyone's attention.
Ayla's spirit is lost in the void, and she can't find her way back. She may not even be able to find her way to the mother. We have to find Jandalar. If we don't get Jandalar here, she will never find her way back. She won't even have the will to try. Search the whole campsite, every tent. Get everyone looking for him. Search the woods, up and down the river. Search in the river if we have to. Just get him here, fast.
Zelandani was more agitated and upset than most people had ever seen her. Everyone, except for those who were needed to chant, rushed out of the lodge and scattered in all directions. When they were gone, the one who was first to serve the mother examined Ayla again. She was still cold, and her skin was turning gray.
She's giving up, the Danyer thought. I don't think she wants to live.
Jandalar may already be too late.
One of the acolytes burst into the phalange used by Jandalar and the two Mamutoi visitors. Willemar and Dalinar were also in the lodge. They had come to look for Jandalar, too. The young acolyte had only seen the tall, red-haired man from a distance and didn't realize how big he was up close. He felt a bit overwhelmed.
"Do you know where Jandalar is?" the young man asked.
"No, I haven't seen him since early this morning," Danug replied. "Why?"
"It's the new Zelindani. She drank some liquid that she made from a root, and now her spirit is in some dark void, and the first said we have to find Jandalar and bring him right away or she will die and her spirit will be lost forever," he said all in one breath without stopping. He finally caught his breath. "We're supposed to search everywhere and ask everyone to help look for him," the acolyte said.
"Could it be that root she took with Mamut?"
Danug asked, looking at Druez with consternation.
"What root is that?"
Dalinar asked, quick to notice their worry.
"Ayla had some root she brought with her from her clan people," Danug explained. "Apparently it was used by the ones who talked to the spirit world. Mamut wanted to try it, so Ayla prepared it the way she had been taught. I don't know what happened exactly, but no one could wake them up. Everyone was worried, and we all had to chant. Finally, Jandalar came and begged Ayla to come back, telling her how much he loved her. They'd been having some trouble, kind of like they are now. I don't understand how two people who love each other so much can be so blind to each other's feelings."
"He has always had trouble with women like that. I don't know if it's pride or lack of perception," Willemar said, shaking his head. "I thought when he brought Ayla home he was past it. He's fine if he really doesn't care that much about a woman. But if he loves one, he seems to lose his sense and doesn't know what to do. You should hear the stories about him, but that's not important."
"What happened?" "Jandalar just kept telling her he loved her and begging her to come back. Finally she woke up and so did Mamut. Mamut told us later they would have been lost in some kind of a black void forever if Jandalar's love hadn't been so strong that it found its way to her. He brought her back. And him, too. Mamut said the roots were too strong. He could never control them and would never try them again. He said he was afraid his spirit would be lost forever in that terrible place, and he warned Ayla against them, too." Danug felt the blood drain from his face. "She's done it again," he said as he ran out of the tent, then wasn't sure where to go. Finally, he had an idea, and he raced toward the camp of the Ninth Cave.
Several people were milling around the large cooking hearth, and he was relieved to see Janela. She had obviously been crying, and Wolf was whining and trying to lick the tears from her face. Marthona and Falara were trying to comfort her, too. They acknowledged the greeting of the big Mamutoi as he hunkered down in front of the little girl. He stroked Wolf's head when the animal nosed his way closer to the familiar man.
"How are you, Janela?"
he said.
"I want my mother, Danug," she said, starting to cry. "My mother is sick. She won't wake up."
"I know she is. I think I know a way to help her," Danug said.
"How?"
she said, looking at him with wide eyes.
"She got sick like this once before, when she lived with us at the lion camp. I think Jandalar could wake her up. He's the one who woke her up before. Do you know where Jandalar is, Janela?"
She shook her head.
"I don't see Jandi very much anymore. He goes away, sometimes all day."
"Do you know where he goes?"
"Lots of times he walks up the river."
"Does he take Wolf with him sometimes?"
"Yes, but not today."
"Do you think Wolf could find him if you told him to?"
Janela looked at Wolf, then back at Danug.
"Maybe he could,"
she said. Then, with a tremulous smile,
"Yes, I think he could."
"If you tell Wolf to find Jandalar, I'll follow him, and tell Jandalar to come back and wake your mother up," Danuk said.
"Mother and Jandi have not been talking very much. Maybe he won't want to,"
Janela said with a worried frown. Danuk thought that she looked exactly like Jandalar when she frowned like that.
"Don't worry about that, Janela. Jandalar loves your mother very much, and she loves him. If he knew she was in trouble, he would run here as fast as he could. I know it," Danuk said.
"If he loves her, why doesn't he talk to her, Danuk?"
"Because sometimes, even when you love someone, you don't always understand her. Sometimes you don't even understand yourself. Will you tell Wolf to find Jandalar?"
"Wolf, come here,"
the girl said. She stood up and took the great massive head between her little hands, just the way her mother would have. She looked so much like a little Ayla, Danuk had to hide a smile. He wasn't alone.
"Mother is sick, and Jandalar has to come and help her, Wolf. You have to find him."
She took her hands away and pointed towards the river.
"Find Jandalar, Wolf. Go find Jandalar," she said.
It was not the first time the wolf had heard that command. Wolf and Ayla had had to follow Jandalar's trail before on their journey back, when he was captured by Ataroa's hunters. The anxious animal licked Janela's face, then started toward the river. He turned around once and started back toward her, but she told him again,
"Go, Wolf! Find Jandalar!"
He looked back when Danug started after him, and then continued on in a fast trot, sniffing the ground. Jandalar could hardly wait to get away from the campsite after his brush with Ayla. Then, once he reached the river and started walking upstream, he couldn't stop thinking about it. He had almost done it, almost taken her in his arms. He had wanted to. Why didn't he? What would she have done if he had? Would she have gotten angry, pushed him away, or not? She had looked so surprised, so shocked. But wasn't he just as surprised to see her? Why didn't he? What was the worst that could happen? If she had gotten angry and pushed him away, would things be any worse than they were now? At least he'd know that she didn't want him. You don't want to know, do you? But things can't go on the way they are now. Was she in tears when she ran away, or did I imagine that? Why would she be in tears? Because she's upset, of course. But what would make her so upset? Just seeing you? Why should that upset her? She told me how she felt on the night of the festival. She showed me, didn't she? She doesn't care about you anymore. But then, why was she crying? Usually, when Jandalar walked along the river, he would think about starting back about the time that the sun reached its zenith at midday. But on this day, his mind was so lost in its ruminations, going over and over again each little nuance he could recall or detail he thought he remembered, that he didn't even notice the passage of time or the height of the sun. Danuk, taking long strides to keep up with the wolf, began to wonder if the animal was on the right trail. Could Jandalar have traveled so far? It was well past noon when Danuk stopped for a quick drink of water before continuing on. He stood up from the river's edge, and far in the distance, along a fairly straight stretch of the winding river, he thought he saw someone walking. He shaded his eyes, but could not see beyond what appeared to be a bend in the waterway. The wolf had rushed on ahead while he had stopped and was out of sight. Danug hoped he'd be able to catch up to him as he started out again, picking up the pace. Jandalar was finally distracted from his intense preoccupation by movement in the brush near the water. He caught sight of the movement again. "It's a wolf. I wonder if he's been stalking me," he said to himself, reaching for his spear thrower.
but he hadn't taken spears or spear throwers. His eyes